Okay, good morning, everybody. How's everybody doing? That's good. So this is Bio 241, and it is Thursday, March 24th. You're scheduled to have a test 1 week from today. And I'm not real optimistic, but I'll let you know at the end of lecture today, or when we're done with the sensory chapter, to see how much time I need. All right, so we got done talking about the ear last time, all right, but I didn't go over the synopsis or just recapitulation of everything that we talked about, okay? Nonetheless, what kind of sense are we talking about, general or special? Special, that's right, because it's just in one or two locations and very highly organized organs are necessary for these modalities. And in the ear, there are three senses, right? So there's hearing, there's static equilibrium, and static equilibrium is measuring what? What is static equilibrium measuring? Linear acceleration. And it just so happens that gravity applies a force on us like linear acceleration, like in an automobile. But where do you feel, if you're in an automobile and you start to accelerate, where do you feel that force? On your back, right? You get accelerated into the back of the chair, right? So you feel that force on your back. But when you're just standing and gravity is pulling on you, where do you feel that force? On the soles of your feet, right? So it's really the exact same kind of force, right? But it's a little bit difficult to visualize, right? So gravity is always accelerating you down toward the center of the earth. But of course, you can't make it there because the surface of the earth is preventing you, or the floor, or the chair that you're sitting on. All right, so that is just a linear acceleration. The second kind is kinetic equilibrium. And what is that sensing? Yeah, some kind of rotation, right? But not just a constant rotation, but a change in rotation. So again, it's going to be an acceleration. So a speeding up of twisting or a slowing down of twisting is what the ear is detecting. So the ear has how many major parts? How many major divisions make up the ear?
Three.
So you got external, right? You've got middle and internal, or inner ear. And you should know where these begin and where they end. But basically, the external ear is what? The pinna right here and the external acoustic meatus, and then it stops at the tympanic membrane. Between the tympanic membrane and the oval window, that's the middle ear. What do you got in the middle ear? You've got auditory ossicles, those bones that vibrate back and forth, right? So we looked at all these things last time, so I'm not going to show you pictures of these things. All right, and then the inner ear has got a bony labyrinth. There's something that looks like a snail, and then something that has a bunch of rings in it, and then something that has like a little bulb. They're all connected together. That's the inner ear. So for hearing, what parts of the ear do you need? Do you need the external ear? Yeah, you need the external ear, because if we took that external auditory meatus and stuck a big cotton ball in there, what would happen to your hearing in that ear? Yeah, it would go away because sound pressure couldn't get and vibrate up against the tympanic membrane. What about the external ear for static equilibrium? Does it play any role whatsoever? The answer is no. And the same thing for kinetic equilibrium. You don't need any kind of external ear for kinetic equilibrium. What about the middle ear? Sure, for hearing, you certainly do, right? Because sound waves have to be conducted through the middle ear via the auditory ossicles, right? But again, the middle ear is not necessary at all for static or kinetic equilibrium. But the internal ear has got organs for hearing, for static equilibrium, and angular acceleration or kinetic equilibrium. So for all three senses, it is necessary, right? So I want you to understand that. All right, so these different senses have different apparatuses. There is a bony labyrinth inside the petrous region. All right, so you should be familiar with the bony labyrinth. That's like the house that all these different organs are located in, the cochlea. What does a cochlea look like? Kind of looks like a snail, right? But really, what is it? It's just the outside of a piano that's all rolled up so that it fits nicely inside your temporal bone. That's the cochlea for hearing. The vestibule is that area that houses the organs for static equilibrium, and the semicircular canals is the bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium. So let's talk about what's inside the bony labyrinth. You have a membranous labyrinth. You have living tissues inside there. All right. So for hearing, it's called the cochlear duct. Contains fluids and the organ for hearing. The utricle and saccule that make up the membranous labyrinth for static equilibrium. And the semicircular ducts is the membranous labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium. All right, but now we want to know what are the exact names of the organs that detect these changes in your environment. Well, the organ of Corti for hearing. So you should have a picture in your mind of what that organ of Corti looks like, at least in one area. And maybe you should know some other things about it. But there is a plate that vibrates up and down. That's called the tectorial membrane. So you should be familiar with that. Okay. The organ for static equilibrium is called a macula. Plural would be maculae. Right? That's a part of the utricle and saccule right here. And for kinetic equilibrium, it's the crista ampullaris. So I think you should be familiar with the structure of each of these three items. One of these items right here actually has little crystals of calcium carbonate, little rocks inside your ear. They're crystals. So which one is that? Is that the organ of Corti, a macula, or a crista ampullaris? The one that has the otoliths is the macula, has the little weights. Okay, so the crista ampullaris has a gelatinous mass, but it doesn't really have any otoliths. So the utricle and saccule are the places where you would find those otoliths. Now, what about the receptor cell? What is the thing that actually depolarizes or hyperpolarizes when sound pressure is presented to it? It's called a hair cell. Right, and it's the exact same kind of cell that's used in a macula and a crista ampullaris for detecting linear acceleration or angular acceleration. So it's the exact same kind of receptor cell. That's kind of interesting. Just been adapted in a little bit different ways to provide you different sensations. Okay, so if the receptors are exactly the same, how come your brain then appreciates different sensations? What allows you to appreciate a particular sensation, right? Obviously, it's not the receptor cell, because here we have basically three receptor cells that are providing you with what? Three drastically different kinds of senses. So it's not the receptor cell. It's what? It's the part of the brain that is being activated by action potentials, right? So it's the job of these hair cells to convert some form of energy in your environment into action potentials. And then those action potentials are taken to specific parts in the cerebral cortex, right? Or other parts, maybe the midbrain, for you to appreciate these different modalities. So it's the part of the brain that gives you perception, not the receptor. All right, so that's important to know. All right, so let's move on to vision. Yes.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
When you have vision.
Yes. Yeah, that dizziness, wow, that's really a loaded term. I'm not sure I even know what dizziness is. Okay, for instance, if you're sitting down right now and then you stand up after a lecture, like a really good long lecture, and you stand up because you got another class you got to get to, and then all of a sudden you kind of feel dizzy or lightheaded. Okay, that really doesn't have anything to do with your ears. That has to do with your blood pressure dropping. And so as you stand up, your blood pressure drops and you don't get so much oxygen to the brain. And so you lose consciousness a little bit. Hopefully not so much that you actually pass out. Okay, so that's one kind of dizziness. But another kind of dizziness is like when the spinning kind of sensation. So I'm not quite sure what you mean by dizzy. Oh, okay. I forgot what that was. I've heard of it, but I forgot. Wow. Yeah. That could be due to an inflammation even of the sensory nerve that goes from the vestibular apparatus, like the vestibulocochlear nerve. I got a feeling it might even be like a viral infection of that nerve. That sometimes, huh? Maybe, but I forgot, so I can't really speak accurately about it. I kind of have to refresh my memory a little bit, okay? Yeah. But yeah, so I think I understand that kind of dizziness, but I couldn't tell you exactly why, yeah, and why it comes and goes, okay? But some viral infections that we have, you know, some of them come and go, like sores on your mouth. Some people get them when they go out in sunlight, and then or under stress they come out. So, and shingles comes and goes, you know, as you approach 60 years old. So I got a feeling it's something like that. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay, we'll go first.
No, I he kept the Disneyland.
Okay. Okay. That's angular. That is angular because when you're in those teacups, you're spinning. And that gets the endolymph spinning in the semicircular canals. And when you stop all of a sudden, your head stops and the crista ampullaris stops because it's glued to your head, but the fluid inside the semicircular canals is still spinning for a period of time. Okay, and as it's spinning, all right, then you get that sense that you are actually spinning, but it's really just the endolymph inside those semicircular canals. Okay, yeah. This diagram right here? Ah, this one, yes. And, you know, I forgot to do it and nobody gave me an email to remind me. But I'll try to do this. Maybe I'll send an email out. I'll send an email out as an attachment. Okay, and so I can do that before I leave campus. I don't know if I can edit the Blackboard site before I leave campus or not. But I can send everybody an email really quickly. So check that one out, right? So you have to just download it as an attachment. Yeah, so you don't have to copy all that down. Okay. Yeah.
Why is it that you step in the opposite direction after you spin?
Why do you...
Like when you're on a teacup, so you kind of get out and you step in the opposite direction of when you're...
Oh, why okay. That's because... I don't know if I have a figure that shows that. Maybe I do have a figure that shows that. All right, so here is just a part of the semicircular canal. All right, so here's the little ampule right here, and the crista ampullaris is the sensory organ inside the semicircular canal. And let's just start with no motion. So here you've been standing for a couple days, not moving, so everything is nice and quiet inside your inner ear. So these hair cells, the stereocilia, are pointing straight up. There's no motion in the endolymph. And so let's now start spinning in this direction. Start spinning, maybe we'll just start spinning to the right. But now the endolymph is just, it has inertia. It wants to stay still. So as we start to move the crista ampullaris through the endolymph that is stationary, can you see that the endolymph is going to push the stereocilia or the cupula here to the left, okay? All right, so then after you're spinning in the teacup for a long period of time, what happens to the endolymph right here? It catches up to your spinning, right? And then when you stop, right, the crista ampullaris stops, but the endolymph is still moving, and that's going to bend the stereocilia back the opposite way. And so that's why you feel like you're spinning the opposite direction when you stop. Because it's the endolymph is pushing the cupula the opposite way compared to how it started to bend at the very beginning. So, I don't know. Sounds like I have to go back to the teacups and actually observe that. That's linear acceleration in a car, not your semicircular canals. Yeah. So when you're just driving, usually you don't have any sense of spinning.
Yeah, but like when you go and you fall like, forward.
Uh-huh. When you stop.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like momentum.
Yes, it has to do with momentum.
So for the linear one, it goes to the way that you go before. For the angular one, you go to the opposite direction. Right?
Well, maybe one way to think of it, when you start to accelerate in a car, mm-hmm. right, you're pushed to the back of your seat, and then when you decelerate, you're pushed toward the steering wheel, right? They're just opposite directions. And so if you just use that same kind of principle to understand the motion of endolymph in a semicircular canal, okay, it's opposite depending on whether you're starting or stopping. It all has to do with inertia. It has to do with inertia, which says that an object doesn't like to change its motion. If it's stationary, it likes to stay stationary. If it is in motion, it likes to stay in motion and not change. That's what inertia is. Okay. So those are the three senses for hearing. And hearing is a measurement of a pressure wave, a physical wave, in moving through air. Vision also can detect waves, but a different kind of wave. It's not a physical wave, it's an electromagnetic wave, where there are highs and lows of electric and magnetic fields that travel through space. All right, so it's really not the same kind of thing as a sound wave. And this right here just shows us the full spectrum of electromagnetic waves depending on what their wavelength is. And the wavelength can be very, very short, right? Like in the case over here of gamma rays and x-rays, or electromagnetic waves can be very long, as in examples of radio waves right here. All right, but our eye cannot see gamma rays or x-rays, can't see radio waves. Right? Our eyes can only detect electromagnetic radiation just in a very small spectrum right here, which we call the visible light spectrum. And the sun, of course, puts out all of these different wavelengths, but our eye only can observe these things right here. Some animals might be able to see some things up in the down in the infrared region, maybe a little bit in the ultraviolet light region right here, but basically all photoreceptors for biology work just in this visible light spectrum. So what do you see right here? You just see a rainbow, right, which is just another name for the visible light spectrum. So white light is when you combine all of these different colors together, your eye will perceive something that's white. And if we take some of these colors away, then, right, the wavelengths that are left is what your eyes are actually perceiving. Okay, and black is the absence of any light on something. If there is a pigment, let's just talk about pigments for a little bit. A pigment is a chemical compound that can absorb light at a particular frequency. And when I say a particular frequency, then that also means what? A particular color, right? Each of these colors is a particular frequency. Like, what is this over here? Is this blue? Purple? Blue? Blue, let's see, there's a way to know all that, right? Roy G. Biv, so here's like red over here, right? And yellow, okay, yeah, green. So if your eye is seeing this color right here, then you have a pigment that is absorbing energy at this particular wavelength or this particular color. And it will be reflecting these colors off. So a pigment is just something that absorbs a particular color of light. Like these chairs right here, they look yellow to me. I don't know if they look yellow to you. Pretty much yellow. So what kind of colors is that pigment in those chairs absorbing? It's absorbing like green and blue and violet over here, as well as red. And what it is not absorbing is yellow. It's reflecting that back to your eye. Okay, so don't forget, a pigment is a chemical compound that can absorb specific kinds of colors. And if it's a pigment, when you look at it, if it looks black, what kind of wavelengths is it absorbing? It's absorbing all colors equally, right? If it looks black, it's absorbing all colors equally. And if it's white, then it's really not a pigment. It's reflecting all colors back to your eye. And when your eye sees white, it sees all these colors mixed together. Okay. So the job of the eye is to transduce this electromagnetic radiation into the language of your brain. What's the language of your brain? Action potentials, right? Okay. And remember, an action potential is an action potential is an action potential. There's no difference, all right? But the reason why you perceive light is because of where these action potentials go. So if your eyes are creating action potentials, where do they go so you have the perception of sight? To the occipital lobe, right? It has to go to the occipital lobe, all right. All right, so there are some accessory structures for vision that allow you to see things. So you have more than just photoreceptors, because light intensity can change dramatically. It can be very dark, sort of like what's in here, or it can be very bright, like when you step outside in bright sunlight. And there's an aperture in your eye, and you're pretty much familiar with the structure of an eye. Probably, have you had your lab on vision yet? I think everybody has had that. Probably reviewed the structure of the eye a little bit there. Okay, but there's an aperture in your eye that changes depending on what the light intensity is. So it adjusts to allow just the right amount of light to touch your retina. So that aperture is what we call the pupil. That's just a hole in the iris right here. So the pupil is not really a structure, it's just a foramen. And this pupil can dilate or it can constrict due to smooth muscles, right, of the iris. And there are radial muscles and circular muscles. When the circular muscles contract right here, then the pupil gets smaller. And that is due to the parasympathetic nervous system, right? So parasympathetic stimulation causes pupil constriction due to contraction of the circular muscles. Under sympathetic stimulation, then these circular muscles relax and the radial muscles contract. So when the radial muscle contract, it pulls on the circular muscle and that dilates, right, the iris, or dilates the pupil, that allows more light to enter the eye. So this is just a way to increase the range of light that is appropriate for your retina for vision. Okay, so you should know sympathetic causes dilation, parasympathetic causes constriction. Okay, I don't know if that's an exam figure or not. There is something else, and that is, you know what, I want to talk about, I think, this slide right here first, just a little bit, okay? And you notice that your eye has some elements that have curvature associated with them. Now, the cornea is transparent so that light can go through it. Here is the lens. The lens is transparent in a normal condition so light can go through it, and then in the posterior pole of the eye over here, this is where the photoreceptors are located inside the retina. Now, when light is coming from a source, okay, it, unlike this slide right here, the light diverges from the source that's emanating that light. But in order for you to see that object clearly, that light has to converge to a point on the retina. So as it's leaving an object, right, it's kind of moving out in like a cone, it's divergent, even though on this diagram it shows all the light rays as being parallel. That's not really the case. It's spreading out. And so it's the job of the eye to take those light rays that are spreading out and then refocus them to just one single point on the retina. And that will give you a nice clear image. So there are curvatures in the eye that do that. So what kinds of things do you see right here that have curvature? What are some of the structures that you see? I see the lens has curvature, and that makes sense because you're familiar with using lenses to clearly bend light so that it focuses on something. Okay? Like you have lenses in a microscope, you got lenses in binoculars, lenses in your camera and things like that, so light can be focused to a single point right here. But there's something else that has curvature to it, and that is the cornea right here also has curvature, and it bends light. So there are two elements right here that work together to focus light on the retina. And by far, the most important thing is the curvature of the cornea. So the cornea has most of the focusing power on your eye. So you might be asking, well, what's the job of the lens then? Why do we even have a lens if the cornea is doing most of the work? Okay. Well, the cornea doesn't change shape, and the lens can. So the lens can make adjustments when you look at something. When you look at something that's very close to you, then the light is spreading apart very rapidly. It's very divergent. So light is spreading apart. So in order to get it back to focus on the retina, it has to be bent to a greater degree to focus on the retina by the time it gets there. But if you have an object way far away, like all the way in the back of the room, these light rays are almost parallel. So since the light rays are parallel, it takes less bending to get them back to focus on the retina. So the closer the object is, the more you have to bend light to focus on the retina. So the job of the lens is so that you can see things up close or far away, of course not at the same time, right? But the lens has to change shape in order to do that. That process is what we call accommodation. All right, so the cornea doesn't change shape, but the lens does. The lens has to be very curved when you're looking at something up close, and then the lens has to flatten out when you look at something that's far away. That's what we call accommodation. So there are some structures in the eye besides the lens. Okay, so accommodation is just the ability to keep an image in focus on the retina as the distance of that object changes from the retina. All right, and it results from contraction of the ciliary muscle right here. So here's the ciliary muscle. It's a circular, smooth muscle. And this muscle can contract and it can relax. There are some ligaments right here that connect this muscle to the lens. So this muscle can put tension on the lens to change its shape. So let's go to this next slide right here. So I see the lens in two different cases. The top case looks like it's pretty flat, and the bottom case looks what? A lot more curvature, right? So it's kind of has been puckered up. It flattens out when there is tension placed on these suspensory ligaments, right? So when the lens is stretched, it flattens out because it's getting pulled. This is what happens when objects are far away from you. Right, so we don't need to bend light quite so much to get it to focus on the retina, because by the time that light reaches your eye, it's almost parallel already. Right? So the tension on the suspensory ligaments increases when the ciliary muscle relaxes. When a muscle relaxes, right, it just gets the diameter of that muscle gets bigger. And as the diameter gets bigger, it puts more tension on the suspensory ligaments and it flattens the lens out. As the object gets closer to your eye, okay, then the divergence of the light increases. It requires more curvature of the lens to focus light on the retina, and we have to take pressure off of these suspensory ligaments. So the circular muscle contracts, and when a circular muscle contracts, what about the diameter? It decreases. When the diameter of that muscle decreases, that takes tension off of these suspensory ligaments, and that allows the natural elastic properties of the lens to cause it to get smaller but thicker with more curvature so that you can see things up close. Okay, so this discussion I think is important because I want you to know what accommodation is, what structures are important. It's what the lens and the ciliary body right here and these suspensory ligaments, so the lens has to change shape. But also know, what are the focusing elements for focusing light on the retina? It's just not the lens, it's also the cornea right here because it has curvature. Okay. And the job of the lens is just to make minor modifications so that you can see things close up or far away. And what is that process called when your eye changes where it focuses at? That's accommodation, right? And you could do a little experiment right now. You could put your hand out in front of your face like that and focus on your fingernail. So your fingernail is in focus, right? Now what about everything behind it? Is it in focus or not? No, I see at least two or three of you guys. Okay? All right, but now focus on something that's way in the background, but concentrate on your fingertip, right? Focus for sure on something that's far away. Now, how many fingertips do you see? Yeah, at least two, right? So you can only focus at one distance at a time. That process of you picking what distance you want to focus at is what we call accommodation, right? And all lens systems work the same way, whether it's your eyes or a camera or a movie camera or whatever. Okay, so that is accommodation. So depending on the shape of a person's eyeball, then that will determine where light is going to focus, where it's going to converge to a particular spot. And that is determined by the distance between the posterior pole and the anterior pole of the eye right here. And some people are fortunate to have the correctly shaped retina or that length exactly right so that light focuses on the retina, right? So then we would call that emmetropia. That's normal vision. Somebody then wouldn't need any kind of corrective lenses to get light focused on the retina. So no correction is necessary. But If somebody has an eyeball that's a little bit too short compared to the curvature of the cornea and the lens right here, light won't focus by the time it's at the retina. It focuses behind the retina, right? So that's what we call farsightedness, because where is that light being focused at? Too far away, okay? Too far behind the retina. And so in order to correct that, then we have to start bending light before it enters the eye with this convex lens right here. So the lens starts to bend light before it reaches the eye, so that now it does focus right on the retina. Okay, so that's hyperopia. Myopia, on the other hand, is nearsightedness, because now the eyeball is too long, light focuses in front of the retina and starts to diverge again by the time it hits the retina, so objects look out of focus. So in this particular case, we would want to spread the light rays out before it reaches the eye, and that's what a concave lens is used for. All right. And then the other condition is, well, our eyes are three-dimensional, right? So this lens is actually a nice disc, and not all the time does it have the same curvature on the top compared to the bottom, or from left to right, and that's what we call astigmatism. So if somebody has astigmatism, light is being bent in different ways depending what part of the lens light falls on. Right? So that when you're looking at an object, a flat object, the whole flat object is not in focus at one time. Part of it is, and then part of it is out of focus. So in order to correct that, then you need an aspherical lens to correct for astigmatism. It will bend light different amounts depending on if it's more anterior or posterior or right and left to correct for astigmatism. Okay, so that has to, we're done talking about that. Okay, let's go on to, away from these accessory structures for vision. All right, well, what are some other accessory structures before we get to this topic right here? We have the lens for focusing, okay, and the cornea for focusing light. What are some other accessory structures for vision? This is just a blast from the past, your anatomy class. Like you have a lacrimal gland, right, that lubricates your cornea. And you have eyelids. What's a name for an eyelid? Maybe a palpebra, does that ring a bell? Right, that protects your eye again. What else protects your eye? Eyelashes, eyebrows, right? And if you want to look at something to the left without turning your head, can you do that? What's necessary to do that? Extrinsic eye muscles. So those are accessory structures to vision as well, but they're not the primary structures. The primary structure for vision is the retina, because it contains photoreceptor cells. Okay, so here is the posterior cavity of the eye that's filled with vitreous humor. And then this is the wall of the eye, and the wall of the eye basically has these three layers, the sclera, the choroid, and then the retina. All right, so the sclera is the superficial. The retina is the deepest layer. So light is coming into the eye, and it's got to pass through all of these structures of the retina. So we have a bunch of neurons, and the photoreceptor cells are deep inside the retina. And there are two kinds. You can see some that just look like tubes, some that kind of look like cones. So these are what we call rod cells, and over here are cone cells. Rod cells are responsible for black and white vision, and the cones for color vision. And this is sort of a lousy diagram, because the rod cells are actually a lot bigger than the cone cells. Maybe there's a better picture of that. So you got to know what cell is responsible for just black and white vision and which is for color. So what kind of vision is better? Is color vision better or black and white vision better? You know what? It's a trade-off. Yeah, so if somebody says depends, then this is true. Okay? So let me see if I can find maybe a better representation. This is probably a little bit better representation right here. All right, notice how big the rod cell is compared to the cone cell. All right, so your black and white vision, because these cells are bigger, are more sensitive to light. So you can see in dim light very nicely using the rod cells. So if it's a very dimly lit room, you're still not blind because the rod cells are working. That's good, but what's the trade-off? You cannot see in color with the rod cells, okay? Now, cone cells are better. They're smaller. They give you a more precise image, better resolution. They also give you color. But what's the trade-off? In order to get these cone cells to work, you need bright light, right? So there's always a trade-off. So the rod cells work in dim light, but you can't see colors, and you can only see coarse objects. You don't have fine detail. Cone cells work only in bright light, but it gives you nice color vision and fine detail. You also have these cells in two different areas on the retina. As light is entering the eye, I guess I want to go back to this picture right here. As light enters the eye, right, it goes right to the posterior pole of the eye. This is where you have your best vision. Right, there's a place right here called the macula lutea, and the very central part of that is the fovea centralis, which only has rod cells right in the posterior pole of the eye. So it's the job of the extrinsic eye muscles to move your eyeballs around so light hits that area right there. All right, so that's what we call your central vision. Central vision is sharp, and you can see in color, but what do you need? Bright light. As you move away from the macula lutea, then those cone cells give away to rod cells, so you have a higher concentration of rod cells in your peripheral vision, and that's where you can see in just shades of gray, but in very, very dim light. And you can use that vision, okay, if you practice. Maybe later on over the weekend, if it's not too cloudy, you can go outside, and you can look up at the sky, and you can see some stars up there. And if you look directly at a starlight as it's coming in, hitting your macula lutea, it might disappear, okay, because it's too dim. But if you keep focusing, now look just to the side of that star, all of a sudden you'll be able to see it because you're going to be observing starlight with your rod cells that are in your peripheral vision, all right, but it won't have any color definition to it because rod cells don't have color. So probably, if you haven't done that already, give that a try over the weekend. Okay, so the two different kinds of cells in two different areas for two different kinds of vision. All right, so let's talk about the retina right here. The rods and cones are deep. You have various layers of neuronal tissue. You have some bipolar cells, right? And what did we say the function of a bipolar cell was? It was always sensory, right? It was always going to be sensory as opposed to a multipolar or a unipolar. Okay, and these bipolar cells carry information from the photoreceptors to amacrine cells and then to ganglion cells, which then carries information, action potentials, to the brain. So there is a lot of signal processing that is taking place in the retina before it even enters the brain. And we're not going to talk very much about that signal processing here. We're just going to focus on some basic transduction schemes of the rod cells. So there are a certain part of the both of these photoreceptor cells that we call the outer segment, right, which contain discs that have pigments in them. And what the heck is a pigment again? What's a pigment? Chemical. It's a chemical compound that absorbs light of some kind, right? Okay, and those pigments are contained in the discs, in this outer segment. New discs are added close to the cell body, and then they move up to this tip of the rod cell or the cone cell, and then they're sloughed off, and the epithelial cells underneath remove that debris from the eye and recycle it. So these discs within the outer segment are always being rebuilt. Okay, now So the retinal pigment phagocytizes debris from the photoreceptor cells, and this photopigment layer here can also absorb light that is entering the eye, not absorbed by the rods and cones, because it would flash around inside your eye and you'd see flashes in there, right? So that's removed. The epithelium also supplies nutrients to the outer segment of these photoreceptor cells, and it provides for some immune defense of the retina as well, and it stabilizes electrolytes in the extracellular environment around these cells. All right, so the pigment in particular of rod cells, and this is the only kind of cell that we're going to talk about in this class, is called rhodopsin, and it's a hybrid molecule. It's part protein. Opsin is a protein. And then there is another organic molecule called retinol. And these are associated. And look at the association between opsin and retinol right here. How would you describe the association between them? It's by what? It's just by the shape, right? It's just by the shape of the molecules. You could think of this as almost like being an active site on an opsin, and the retinol fits in it. And you see the long carbon backbone of retinol. This is in this what we call a cis conformation. Depending on the position of these double bonds right here, it can form a bend, right, which then fits nicely into the opsin molecule. Right? But when this retinol absorbs light, it changes conformation to where now it's a more linear conformation of this hydrocarbon, and now it doesn't fit into the active site of the opsin molecule. So when you see things, the initial reaction is a change in conformation of retinol from when it fits in opsin compared to when it does not fit in. Okay? And that reaction is what we call a bleaching reaction. And the energy that is necessary to cause this conformation change, right, is energy that is contained in this thing right here, which is what? Which is light, right? And so it's the shape of retinol that absorbs this particular form of radiation or this wavelength of radiation. And when there's a change in conformation, when retinol dissociates from the opsin molecule, that causes a permeability change in membranes within the rod cell to various ions. So when you change permeability to electrolytes on a cell, what are you doing to the cell? When you change permeability to various electrolytes, you're changing the membrane potential, right? So you're adjusting the potential across the cell membrane. And if it causes depolarization, that stimulates the cell. If it causes hyperpolarization, that inhibits the cell. So I don't even think I want to read this. I want to show you some pictures first and then maybe talk about that in just a little bit. Rods contain many sodium channels. And this is kind of strange, okay, because under most circumstances, what is one way that you think of excitation or stimulation? How would you want to stimulate a cell? By depolarizing it. And what's a very nice way that you can depolarize a cell? Open up a sodium channel, right? Okay. Now the visual system works in an opposite sense. All right. In the dark, many sodium channels are open. So in the dark, do you have stimulus or is that the absence of stimulus? In the dark. That's the absence of stimulus because light is stimulus. So in the absence of stimulus, what's happening to a rod cell? It is depolarizing. It is actually being stimulated in the dark. So that's just the opposite kind of scheme that we've been looking at before. So because that depolarization is happening in the dark as a result of influx of sodium into the rod cells, we call that a dark current, right? Because this is a positive charge in motion entering the cell. That's an electrical current. That happens during the dark. When light hits the rod cells, it actually closes these sodium channels, all right? And so that depolarization stops, okay? And we call that what? Hyperpolarization when the sodium channels close. That's when the rods become inhibited when there is the presence of the stimulus. So that's really kind of an opposite way that we're familiar with how receptors work. Okay, so let's look at a rod cell. So here's the plasma membrane. Here's the extracellular space. And here is a disc in the outer segment of the cell, and let's look under dark conditions. So in a dark condition, that is what? Stimulus or the absence of a stimulus? Absence of a stimulus. All right, so you have rhodopsin, and it's connected to a G protein. And you know that the G protein has these three subunits right here. And phosphodiesterase, I don't think we've talked about this enzyme right at the moment, but it is the antagonist to adenylate cyclase. Anybody ever hear of adenylate cyclase? Yeah, we talked about it before. Maybe you don't have it on the tip of your tongue. But adenylate cyclase will take ATP and will chop off two phosphates, making an AMP out of it, but a special kind of AMP, one that forms a ring that we call cyclic AMP. All right, now what do you know about cyclic AMP? It can be used as a second messenger to change physiology or chemical reactions inside the cell. Okay, so in the dark, phosphodiesterase is inactive, and the job of phosphodiesterase is to break down cyclic compounds like cyclic AMP and cyclic GMP. And GMP just stands for what? Guanylate monophosphate. It's an analog to adenosine monophosphate. So the cyclic GMP binds to a receptor, which is it's a ligand-gated sodium channel in the dark. So sodium is always entering the cell in the absence of stimulus, which what does what? It depolarizes the cell. Now, when light is present, then rhodopsin absorbs that light, right, and that activates the G protein, and the alpha unit moves over to this phosphodiesterase and activates it. And the job of a phosphodiesterate is what? The antagonist to, like, adenylate cyclase. So that breaks down cyclic GMP to regular old GMP. So now the sodium channel right here closes when you have the light stimulus. All right, so now you don't have depolarization of the cell. You have repolarization of it. All right, so let's look at the next slide. We can kind of put it all together. All right, so again, we have two conditions. We have in the dark and in the presence of stimulus, and this is a nice rod cell. In the dark, we have high levels of cyclic GMP, right, because phosphodiesterase is not activated. All right, so in the dark, and since we have high levels of cyclic GMP, what can you tell me about this sodium channel right here? It's a ligand-gated channel, but the ligand is intracellular. It's not coming from the outside. Right? So when cyclic GMP binds to this sodium channel, it keeps it open. Sodium can enter the cell. Right? So this is what we call the dark current. So you have this electrical current entering the cell. And this cell then becomes depolarized. Right? And when it's depolarized, it releases neurotransmitter, which then stimulates this bipolar cell. Now, this neurotransmitter, remember, neurotransmitters can produce EPSPs or IPSPs, depending on receptors. What's an EPSP? Excitatory postsynaptic potential. And what's an IPSP? Inhibitory postsynaptic potential. So this particular neurotransmitter is binding to receptors that produce IPSPs on the bipolar cell. So in the absence of stimulus, the rod cell is excited, but the bipolar cell is inhibited as a result of that, because this is a inhibitory neurotransmitter producing IPSPs on bipolar cells. So if the bipolar cell is inhibited, is that going to send any action potentials to the brain? No action potentials to the brain in dark conditions, which means what? Means the absence of a stimulus, so you don't see anything. All right, well, let's turn light on. So we turn the light on, and retinol absorbs that light, right? That activates a phosphodiesterase. And what does that phosphodiesterase do once again? Phosphodiesterase breaks cyclic GMP down into regular old GMP. That doesn't bind to this ligand-gated channel anymore because it doesn't have the right shape, right? It's got to have the right shape to bind to it. So the sodium channel closes, that repolarizes the cell, that inhibits the rod cell, so the rod cell doesn't release any neurotransmitter. So now the bipolar cell is relieved from that inhibition, so it depolarizes, releasing excitatory neurotransmitter on the ganglion cell. And when the ganglion cell binds that excitatory neurotransmitter, which produces EPSPs, what happens on these axons then? Then action potentials are generated and they're sent to the visual cortex, which is the occipital lobe. All right, so this scheme is pretty strange because the rod cells are stimulated in dark, right, but inhibited when the stimulus is present. But the reason why it works is because rod cells release a inhibitory neurotransmitter on bipolar cells. All right, so to help you get that straight in your mind, this is an exam figure. So just labeling this thing a number of times will help you get in the flow of how it works. All right, I don't know if you just look at it one time if it will make sense. All right, so here is, okay, just kind of a synopsis of how it works. And now maybe it might make a little bit of sense. The ganglion amacrine cells produce action potentials, right? So these are the cells that produce action potentials. Rods and cones, bipolar cells and horizontal cells produce graded potentials, right? The visual transduction is inverse to other sensory systems, meaning that in the absence of light, that's when the rod cell is depolarizing. And usually you think depolarization is an excitatory event, but not in terms of the visual system. In the dark, photoreceptors release that inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarizes bipolar cells. And what's the job of a bipolar cell? It stimulates these ganglion cells to produce action potential. So when bipolars are inhibited, then the ganglion cells are not excited. Right? So light inhibits photoreceptors from releasing that inhibitory neurotransmitter, thus stimulating the bipolars. And when bipolars are stimulated, they stimulate ganglion cells to transmit action potentials to the brain, which then, right, form your perception of vision. Okay, so that's an interesting thing. So what are some of the take-home things that you have to know? Well, know what the antagonistic enzyme is to adenylate cyclase, which is phosphodiesterase, right? So adenylate cyclase makes a cyclic AMP or GMP, right? A phosphodiesterase will break it down. And so it's going to be the balance of those two enzymatic reactions that regulates this gated channel right here. Okay. All right, so that's it for the sensory chapter. So look at these diagrams over the weekend, and then you'll have to ask me something about them on Monday if you got some questions. But you're definitely going to have to look at them a couple times. And I want to talk about the endocrine system a little bit. Let me open it up and just kind of take a look here what we've got going. Yeah, you know, I just can't do that in one lecture. And I basically have just one lecture in a little bit to talk about the endocrine chapter. And I just don't think you guys would be ready for the test a week from today. So we're going to have to reschedule that test for the Monday after that. Yeah, the Tuesday after that. And let's see if I have a date. So I want to get this. So it's going to be before spring break, thank goodness, but it looks like it's going to be on April 5th. Instead of March 31st. All right, so test number 3 on April 5th. Now, if I do finish endocrinology, I will move on to the muscle chapter before the test a little bit, okay? So we might cover a little bit of muscle by the time you get to exam 3. All right, so we looked at nervous system already, and the job of the nervous system is for communication. But it also receives signals, so you can communicate with your environment, and sending that information over long distances in your body with what kind of speed? Slowly or rapidly? Very rapidly, right? So nervous system transmits signals very rapidly over long distances in your body, and typically you'll find that when something has a very fast onset of action, if it starts to take effect very fast, the duration of that action is very short, okay? But on the other hand, if the onset of action is long, the duration lasts for a long period of time, all right? So I'm kind of comparing and contrasting the nervous system and the endocrine system. So some systems in your body take effect very rapidly, but they live for a very short period of time, okay? And other systems in your body might take a little bit longer to develop, but they control your body for a longer period of time. And the endocrine system is that way. It's slower to develop a control mechanism, but the duration will last a lot longer. So the endocrine system is very nice because it can control your body over the long term very nicely, though it can't operate as fast as the nervous system. Okay, so let's talk about some things about endocrine system. Okay, endocrine glands. Let's talk about some endocrine glands. Well, here we have a number of endocrine glands all over the body. Pituitary gland, right underneath the diencephalon in the brain, hypothalamus, which is part of the diencephalon in the brain. And then we have the thyroid gland. We have the pancreas, the adrenal gland, and then we have some gonads here, whether they're testes or ovaries, that secrete hormones. So what the heck is an endocrine gland? It's something that secretes a hormone, but let's review what an endocrine gland is. What's another kind of gland? We could break all glands down into two general classes, endocrine and exocrine, right? So an exocrine gland is a gland that is producing a product that it secretes, but it secretes it into a duct. And that duct takes that product to the organ where it's going to perform its function. A good example of an exocrine gland is this pancreas right here, because it produces digestive enzymes, right? But we don't want those digestive enzymes to work within the pancreas, because what would happen to the pancreas? It would become digested, right? It would digest itself. So those digestive enzymes are placed into the pancreatic duct, which carries it to the small intestine, and that's where they do their job. So the pancreas has an exocrine function, right? An endocrine gland does not have a duct. So how does a product of an endocrine gland get to where it's going to perform its function? It gets picked up by a capillary, right? And it gets into the blood, and blood carries it everywhere in the body. And why is it that you need a capillary? Because capillaries are the only place in the circulatory system where exchange takes place, because capillaries have what? The thinnest wall. Doesn't have all the different layers. And remember, there are different kinds of capillaries. Some are more leaky than others. And it just so happens that the pancreas right here also have cells that are endocrine, right, as well as exocrine. So the pancreas is part exocrine gland and endocrine gland as well. So we'll look at that. So that's why we have it on this slide. But I had to use it as a good example of an exocrine gland. So the pituitary is an endocrine gland because it uses the cardiovascular system to distribute its products, right? And that product is what we call a hormone. So a hormone is something that is produced by an endocrine gland, which is a ductless gland, right? And it's carried by the blood all over the body, and it's going to change the physiology in cells in these distant locations in your body. But in order for these cells in these distant locations in your body to be sensitive to a hormone, what does it have to have? It has to have a receptor to that particular signaling molecule or hormone, which is what? Complementary in shape to the hormone itself. Okay, so some hormones are secreted by tissues that develop from epithelium. Other hormones are secreted by neurons, which is part of what? Nervous tissue. Right? So sometimes, what do we typically call a signaling molecule that's released by a neuron? We call it a neurotransmitter, right? If it just diffuses across a synapse to bind to a receptor on a neighboring cell. But if that neurotransmitter is picked up by the circulatory system and then transported to a distant site where it leaves another capillary and binds to a receptor at a distant site, then it's kind of acting like a hormone. But since it's coming from a neuron, right, it really kind of sounds like a neurotransmitter, so the proper name for that is combining both of those ideas, and then we call it a neurohormone. So there are some neurons that secrete signaling molecules directly into the blood, and we call those neurohormones. And a good example would be when certain cells of the hypothalamus release signaling compounds that get picked up by the blood, because these are neurons in the hypothalamus. These are all neurohormones. Okay, and these hormones affect metabolism of target tissues. And again, what does a target tissue have to have in order to be a target tissue? It's got to have a receptor. That's right. Okay, so here is a list of hormones. We're going to be talking about some of these, or actually most of these. And some organs we see, like the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas, are releasing two hormones right here, insulin and glucagon. You probably have heard of insulin, okay? Maybe not glucagon, but maybe from lab you have already learned something about glucagon. But when I see pairs of hormones right here, something very interesting kind of pops into my imagination. And that is, I have a tendency to think of the autonomic nervous system. How many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? It's got two. And what's the relationship between them? They're antagonistic, right? So the effects of these hormones are antagonistic to each other, and at first glance you might think that that's kind of a silly, futile system, right? If you have one hormone, like insulin, that decreases blood glucose, why do you want to have another hormone that increases blood glucose? Because when you have antagonism, then you have balance and fine control over a very important parameter, namely blood glucose concentration. So it's the balance of these two hormones that maintains your glucose in the proper region, proper level. A couple other hormones that are antagonistic to each other would be parathyroid hormone, and calcitonin. Both of these come from an area near the thyroid gland. Here's thyroid gland, calcitonin. All right, these will have opposite effects on blood calcium levels. Okay, one will increase blood calcium, the other will decrease. Is it important to have proper levels of blood calcium? What do you need calcium for? You need it for bones, okay, but bones really is a reservoir for calcium. But why do you want to have the proper extracellular concentration of calcium? We haven't talked about muscle contraction yet, but obviously that is one important thing. Maybe from anatomy you kind of learned that, but also for synaptic transmission, right? So neurons can't even communicate with each other without the proper levels of calcium in the extracellular space. So if you had to pick, where would you want to have proper levels of calcium? Would you pick your bones, or would you pick extracellular space so that neurons can't communicate with each other? Well, it's much better to have a nervous system than strong bones, right? And as we age, your body makes that same decision as well and gets calcium from bones unless you take some steps to counteract that effect. And what can you do to protect your bones? Make sure you have proper calcium in your diet, but what else do you have to do? You have to exercise as well, right? Because in order to make strong bones, you have to exercise them, just like a muscle. In order to have a strong muscle, you have to exercise that muscle. When you exercise a muscle, it hypertrophies and gets bigger. And when you put stress on a bone, what does it do? It gets bigger and stronger as well, right? It absorbs calcium from your diet to a much greater degree. So that as we age, bigger, stronger bones can afford to lose more calcium before they get weak. Right, so that's how you can protect yourself. All right, so think of antagonism when we're working through some of these different hormones right here. Okay, let's talk about some classes of hormones. Some are amine hormones, which are derived from tyrosine and tryptophan. These are amino acids, and these are kind of special amino acids because your body can't make them, which means that they are essential. You have to have them in your diet. Right, and these produce things like norepinephrine and epinephrine that you learned were neurotransmitters, but there is one organ that actually secretes them as a hormone. Okay, so these also act as hormones in your body. Thyroxine from the thyroid gland and melatonin from the pituitary, right, are also based on these amino acids right here. And what's a dietary source of tyrosine and tryptophan? Yeah, it's got to be a meat protein, right? It's got to be from an animal, not a plant protein. So you have to watch your diet, and we don't have time to talk about that. Okay. Some are polypeptides. So they're not just single amino acids, but there are a number of amino acids put together. Some are very short, maybe 5 or 6 or 8 amino acids. Sometimes it's a little bit longer. All right, these include antidiuretic hormone. What does a diuretic do? I don't think we've talked about this yet, but I can't quite remember. A diuretic makes you pee, and antidiuretic makes you retain water, right? So antidiuretic hormone makes you retain water in your body. Growth hormone, insulin, oxytocin, glucagon, adrenal corticotropic hormone, parathyroid hormone, these are all polypeptide hormones. So these are all soluble in water, right? So these are hydrophilic kinds of molecules. Glycoproteins are also hydrophilic molecules, so it's just a protein that has been conjugated with a sugar molecule. And for examples of this would be gonadotropins, LH and FSH, and thyroid stimulating hormone. And then the last class right here are based on steroids. What was the simplest kind of steroid that you're aware of? The cholesterol, right? So all of these hormones are derived from cholesterol by some kind of modification of the cholesterol molecule, And what kind of general molecule is cholesterol? Is it a protein or is it a sugar? It's a lipid. What can you tell me about lipids? They are, in terms of its nature for water. It doesn't like water. They are hydrophobic, right? So they don't like to dissolve in water. Okay, but since they don't like to dissolve in water, they do like to dissolve in lipids. And what do you have in the plasma membrane? Yeah, it's a phospholipid bilayer, so these hormones can enter the cell very nicely, while all of these others above it, the amine, polypeptide, and glycoproteins, cannot enter a cell. Right? But steroid hormones do enter a cell. Some examples would be testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, and some other hormones from the adrenal gland. So they're going to have different actions. So this slide right here just shows you that for steroid-based hormones, you start with cholesterol, and then it undergoes various modifications to become other kinds of hormones. And the only interesting thing that I see right here is that estrogen is converted from testosterone. Maybe I'll make a point of that later on. Okay, so that in order to have estrogen, testosterone has to be produced first. All right? But before any of these are produced, you have to have cholesterol. Right? So your body cannot be devoid of cholesterol, because then you would be devoid of all of these important hormones. Another lipid soluble, and I think I'll probably stop maybe right after this slide, another lipid soluble hormone, okay, is thyroid hormone. And, this is actually kind of apropos in today's world. Here is a thyroid hormone, and in order for it to be active, it needs an element of iodine. Okay, and so here is a thyroid hormone that has four atoms of iodine on it. So we call this tetraiodothreonine. Threonine is the base molecule. So we call this T4 because it has these four moieties of iodine on it. And here is a little bit of modification of it. This is triiodothreonine, or T3. And the reason why this is kind of important today, because the thyroid gland actively takes up iodine from our diet and concentrates it, and unfortunately, there is a radioactive form of this iodine that's produced in nuclear reactors. Fortunately, it doesn't have a very long half-life, all right? But since the thyroid gland is always actively taking up iodine, if it's a radioactive form, then the thyroid gland is going to be predisposed to cancers as a result, because that radioactivity is damaging to chromosomes, all right? And so that's the basis of some people taking potassium iodide, because we know everybody's thyroid gland is going to be taking up a lot of iodine, and if you give it a lot of normal iodine, then it's going to have less of a tendency to take up the radioactive form. At least that's the theory, though I don't know if that's ever been proven scientifically. So I don't think I would maybe run out and buy any potassium iodide to protect your thyroid gland, right? Because I don't think it's ever really been shown to work. But some people get kind of spooked with this radioactive stuff, and maybe they want to spend some money. So we're going to start here with hormone actions and interactions next time. Sign-in sheet? Yeah, the sign-in sheet is around someplace.